ICE arrest for doing this. And then they proceed an entire episode talking about America. I learned nothing about what's happening right now here in Canada, so I went to read some news articles. Globe and Mail told me a little bit about what was happening in Montreal, at least the official statements, like McGill administration said that this was not okay. They had evidence of anti-Semitism at the protests, and most, if not all, of the people on campus, the administration said, were not part of the McGill community. Okay, that's interesting. Is that true? So then the Globe quotes protesters who say, well, no, part of that's not true. I did not learn from reading those news stories how many protesters there were at McGill or at other Canadian university encampments that were popping up. I did not learn whether it's true or not that the protesters are students or not students. I did not learn whether or not those claims of anti-Semitism had any merit or not. And the Globe's reporter, Frederick Xavier Plante, wrote that McGill alleged video evidence of anti-Semitism but did not provide specifics, which is true. McGill initially did not provide specifics. It took me about 30 seconds to find specifics. Here is a video that was shot from the McGill encampment.
But my family is from Iraq.
Okay, and what we see in that clip are a group of protesters, some with their, you know, faces covered, in a confrontation with two other people whose faces are not covered, and they're singing that rhyme. I've heard that rhyme a bunch of times now. They say that they're indigenous, but they all come from Europe. Leave Palestine alone, leave Palestine alone, leave Palestine alone, and then go back to Europe. Have you heard that rhyme?
Yeah. And I've seen this clip as well. I think we have to really kind of grapple with what we're actually talking about here, because there's a lot of stuff going on, right? So you know, let's start at the very high level. There are encampments and there are protests against the war in Gaza in favor of a ceasefire. That is fundamentally what we're talking about. The thing that has sort of sprung up across campuses, the thing that has attracted Jewish students, right? The thing that has attracted groups like Independent Jewish Voices and others, you know, the premise of why students are coming out for these things is, I want the war to end and I don't want my university or my city or my whatever, my government, involved in prosecuting this war, right? It would be absurd to say every single person who comes out to those protests or joins those encampments is singing along with these chants or agrees with the premise or would say those kind of horrendous things, right? We got to put that on the table because that is just, I think, patently true.
Sure.
Okay, so let's drill down. Are there people out there who are saying truly horrible things, whether it's go back to Europe, whether it's 10, 100, 10,000, October 7th, you know, as you heard people chanting in Colombia, you heard similar things chanting in Ottawa in front of the parliament buildings. Are people saying those things? Yes. Like, we've seen them. But we, I think, have lost all proportionality of how common it is, right? Because we tend to think that what gets filtered through in terms of videos through Twitter that winds up in the news becomes representative of overall protest movements, and we just know that's not true. I mean, sit there and count the actual number of people who you hear saying these things on videos. You're talking about a dozen, two dozen, three dozen, right? Across maybe North America. Is that representative of a protest movement that now encapsulates thousands, tens of thousands of people? I don't think so. To what degree is that true? I don't know. How could we imaginably find out? And I think the comparisons to the 60s are really useful here, because you go back to the 60s and there are students who are chanting, you know, ho, 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 Ho Chi Minh. They're waving Viet Cong flags. They're screaming, kill the cops, kill the pigs, right? Does that mean every single anti-war demonstrator, does that mean the anti-war demonstrations themselves are defined by Viet Cong style Maoism? No, of course not. That would be ludicrous to say. Looking back now, we actually have a nostalgia for those anti-war protests. So why are we holding all of these pro-Palestinian protests to the standard of what we see bubbling up through a handful of videos on Twitter? I think it's manifestly unfair.
Who's doing that?
I think we are right now. I think the media is doing that. I think to some degree you're doing that. And
am I?
And listen, there's nothing wrong with saying that these videos, that these chants, that these slogans, whatever, are problematic, are in some cases anti-Semitic, are in some cases even an appeal to violence. Yeah. part of the problem I have is that these videos and these chants are becoming justification for a complete kind of, generalization of all these protests. I hear them called pro-Hamas rallies all the time. I think that's incredibly troubling. And I think they're a justification for sending in the police and inflicting actual violence on actual students. And I think that's really troubling. I think we have to, whenever we talk about these things, try and put them in as much context and with as much proportionality as we possibly can.
I'll put them in context. I agree with you there. And I think we're going to land in the same place, which is that I do not want to see happen in Canada what we saw in the States. I do not want to see a nonviolent protest, which is different than a peaceful protest. Sure. And that's not even a negative statement. I don't think protests are supposed to be peaceful. Protests exist to disrupt the peace. There's a difference between peaceful and nonviolent. These are not peaceful protests, but they are in Canada nonviolent protests, these ones that we're seeing in the universities. I do not want to see cops coming in and breaking them up, arresting people and pepper spraying people and everything that comes with it. But we got to slow down because you said a whole bunch of things there. Whether or not anti-Semitism is occurring matters.
Sure.
And it is something that just about every news story about this grapples with. But it's doing a poor job of actually bringing us answers. As a member of the affected community, it's not as important to me as it seems to be to you whether this is representative of the whole thing. If one person is shouting at a university to a black student, go back to Africa, it doesn't really matter to a black person there if there are 10 people who are not saying that. But if that happens at every protest, then there is harmful racism happening regularly. And if you are paying attention, which I've made it my business to pay attention, this is something that happens a lot. These are common chants. And it's not just about a bad apples thing. It's about the organizers. Palestine Youth Movement published a video of protesters at McGill chanting, "From water to water, Palestine is Arab." That is a different statement than "from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free," which, depending on how you interpret that, yes, I would hope that Palestinians would be free everywhere. And that's an interpretation that doesn't necessarily carry any kind of like ethno-state intent. But that's a different thing. And there was somebody with a Hamas patch. If the question that the media is asking is there anti-Semitism on these campuses, to say, go back to Europe, we can say definitively and objectively, that is a anti-Semitic statement, and a ludicrous one for a couple of reasons.
Sure.
One of which is like, go back to Europe. Well, I'm not from Europe. My ancestors are from Europe. They left for a reason. That student that it was aimed at was actually, he says in that clip, my family's from Iraq. Okay. So when you say go back to Europe, you're erasing brown Jews and black Jews and Jews from Arab countries. There's no going back to Iraq if your family is from Iraq. And it is triply stupid because it was sung to the tune of Yankee Doodle Dandy. Justin, how are you going to do an anti-colonial rhyme to the tune of Yankee Doodle Dandy? It's just not good. But these are increasingly frequent messages. Montreal for Palestine, one more. Because as journalists, like you said, the context matters. Montreal for Palestine put out a video that starts with, "Stop calling for a ceasefire.
Stop calling for a ceasefire. It is not going to get us anywhere."
So you brought up, this is a very understandable thing, and I'm getting a very different impression from a lot of people who I think are feeling very sympathetic to students because they're being told that this is a peace protest, which a lot of people feel sympathetic to. And it does evoke this romanticism of the 60s, going to campus and just saying, ceasefire, peace. And the media uncritically is like, well, I'm just here. I don't know anything about this, but I'm here and there's a big ceasefire sign up. That's fine. Report that there's a ceasefire sign up. But if it says, stop calling for a ceasefire, and they're calling for an all-Arab ethno state, and they're wearing Hamas patches, it's not so simple to say that this is a peace protest.
Listen. Absolutely fine. If you go to a protest and you get a microphone in someone's face and they decide to say something completely outlandish and offensive and, you know, the idea that we need to erase Israel from the map, by all means, quote them. I'm not saying don't. But I think what you just said is wrong, right? I mean, you actually look at the stated aims of every single protest that I'm familiar with. They are ceasefire emphatically and repeatedly. Even those groups, and there are groups, a lot of groups.
Among other stated goals.
Well, just hang on. I'm getting to those other stated goals. But even amongst those groups who have, frankly, justified the violence of October 7th, which I think is abhorrent, you know, groups that call it legitimate resistance, I think is disgusting. But those groups are also still calling for a ceasefire and end of the violence and the release of the hostages, which I think is a thing we can agree with. You can hate some of the politics of these groups and still agree with their final kind of stated policy position.
But what does it matter if you call for a ceasefire and peace while you're praising Hamas and saying, let's have 100 more October 7ths?
I mean, are those groups actually praising Hamas and saying, no, I mean, yes, again, you're conflating an organization with a chant made by a random person, and I don't think that's fair.
Palestine Youth Movement published that video with the Hamas patch and with let's call for an all-Arab state.
Okay, fine.
Montreal for Palestine published the video that said, let's stop calling for a ceasefire. So there's some dissonance here.
Yes, fine. And if you wanted me to say group this is, Montreal for Palestine, they're bad. Fine.
I'm not trying to get you to say that at all. I think we just have to be very clear-eyed and we have to be accurate about at the organizational level, because a lot of people rank and file show up to these things just to call for ceasefire. I think that's the majority of the people who show up. But we are seeing a normalization of overtly racist rhetoric and goals that go way beyond. I mean, nobody went to Kent State and said, let's get out of Vietnam, and by the way, America should be abolished.
What's so funny is, yes, they did. Many of the protesters at Kent State actually wanted, like, total demilitarization. They wanted a communist revolution. A bunch of them burned down the recruitment center for the American forces, right? Like, there was a constant argument that the protesters at Kent State were radicals who wanted to destroy America. There was a argument going through every major newspaper in the country, even being voiced in Congress, that the protesters on campuses across the country, including civil rights leaders like MLK Jr., were in fact communist agents who wanted to overthrow America. So there absolutely was this argument that they had this ulterior motive that was actually running through their movement.
Well, those details did not make it into the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song that I'm familiar with.
It was in the extended cut. But listen, like, you know, at Columbia, they had all of their demands written on a thing before you walked in. It's the same demands they made in negotiations.
The demands at McGill are written out there, and they start with ones that seem like, okay, yeah, like, let's divest from, like, arms supporting. And then there's, like, also McGill is invested in Shake Shack, and Shake Shack has locations in Israel, so let's divest. All right, whatever. And then you get into, like, let's cut off all academic ties to Israel. So there's a creep of mission. It's like, really?
We're
like,
sure. And you can disagree with that, and that's fine. Disagree with it.
I'm not trying to disagree with anything. I'm trying to actually just get clarity on what's being asked for.
Absolutely. But here, let me raise one other point, because I think it's useful. I think we have wound up putting these students under a microscope, which I think is unfair. I mean, listen, students believe radical and stupid things. I used to wear Che Guevara t-shirts, right? That was stupid and bad. Students say outlandish and sometimes just offensive things. You know, I heard Kamani James, one of the organizers for these Columbia protests, on a live stream from earlier this year, saying that violence and murder against Zionists is justified because they're white supremacists. God, obscene. But the kid's 20 years old, right? Like, he has not fully formed his political identity yet. And, you know, putting him as a international sort of villain, suspending him from university isn't going to fix that. What makes people shed those radical beliefs, and in some cases actual anti-Semitism, is interacting with the real world, fully fleshing out your political philosophy, and actually having to deal with, in some cases, Jews, right? And then you start to realize that maybe my dumbass youthful rebellion phase is as dumbass as it actually sounds. And listen, I was at a counter protest in New York after I left the Columbia campus. It was led by evangelical Christian, but it featured a bunch of Jews, many of whom were chanting, you know, bring them home, and waving posters of the Israeli hostages, and entirely reasonable and understandable. But, you know, I saw one woman waving a sign that said, from the river to the sea, this is the only flag. And it was the Israeli flag. That seems to me like just as offensive, right?
Absolutely.
I heard people saying that the students inside were driven by the Antichrist. I heard them say Palestine isn't real. I heard them, you know, heckling and harassing students. Yet that got literally zero coverage. I'm telling you, genuinely, honestly, zero coverage. The only extended version of that I saw was on Fox, where they interviewed one of the participants who said, actually, their protest was perfect. It was the pro-Palestinian protesters who harassed them and threatened to kill them, which is just manifestly untrue. So I think we hold these students to an impossible standard that we don't hold to other groups, and I think it's unfair.
I definitely saw footage of counter-protesters behaving in racist ways. There was this, like, Jewish boxer dude who used the N-word. That certainly got into my feeds, and it's abhorrent, and I'm glad that that is part of my understanding of what happened, because there are certainly people who are lashing back with an equal amount of ignorance, racism, and we need to know about that, too.
But we'd never say that that these rallies in support of Israel are inherently anti-Palestinian or inherently Islamophobic or inherently anti-Palestine.
I don't know that, like, what you're basing that characterization of the student, like, the idea that these, the student protests are inherently or completely something that you keep asserting, but it's not something that I've seen in coverage or anything that certainly that I'm saying.
I think when we center most of our conversation about the one-off bad things they chant or say, we're effectively doing that.
No, don't give me the bad apples thing.
We are. I think we're universalizing it.
And I feel the same thing here. Like, it's a failure of civil discourse, because, again, these are nonviolent protests. Whatever they ain't saying it. They're not using their fists, right?
I think we also have to accept that, you know, yes, anti-Semitism here is a problem. How do you disrupt that? You disrupt that through discourse and through negotiation and conversation and debate. And I don't, you know, want to too fetishize the idea of the free market of ideas. But, you know, if these people believe in a form of anti-Semitism or radicalism, then I think we can help disabuse them of that notion while also kind of keeping them, you know, on the trajectory of being pro-Palestine. Like, I think that's entirely possible. You don't solve that by sending in the cops.
And Justin, just a quick update on this topic. Just received word that the injunction that was being sought by a couple of McGill students that would have facilitated a police response to the encampment on McGill campus has been rejected by the courts. That probably means we will not be seeing a police response to that protest.
I mean, we'll see. The university clearly has asked. They were asking for the police to move in even before this injunction was heard. They want this encampment gone. So I think they probably won't move in, but we'll see what happens.
I would like to see this just play out its course. The protesters have their say. It's easy for me to say. I'm not the person who has to absorb, go back to Europe on campus when I'm just trying to go to school. But I think that the best outcome for this is that the point gets made and campus life moves on.
Justin Trudeau, possibly the most polite prime minister in the world.
Would you like to introduce yourself, sir?
Yeah, hi, it's Justin Trudeau, and I'm prime minister right now.
Your team reached out to us to come on this podcast.
I have to ask you, why did you want to talk with me?
Where do electric vehicles and announcements like this today fit into the big picture of our fight against climate change?
I'm curious if you use cannabis yourself.
Like, Canadians are there to push an old lady's Buick out of a snowbank.
As Wayne Gretzky once said, going where the puck is going, as opposed to where the puck is.
I've been a big fan for a long time. I actually dusted off my old copy of Freakonomics last night.
I'm not a natural extrovert. I'm an introvert who's learned how to, you know, draw energy.
I've tried it, but it's never been my thing. I'm much more of a beer and bourbon kind of guy, even then not too much. Why do I continue to read massive amounts of fiction? Because story is the only thing that matters.
Well, there's our prime minister doing a little podcast tour. He has been handpicking outlets and offering them his company for these interviews, and I got through a couple of them. Our producer James diligently sat through all of them. I learned nothing.
No.
Not a thing.
Nope.
What is going on here? I read that this marketing guru Max Valiquette is now running things for the beleaguered prime minister. It's a very strange flex to me. Like, I know as a publisher of podcasts that Canadians listen to more American, they do Canadian podcasts. So you actually can reach a certain demographic who listens to Freakonomics, who listens to Today Explained on Vox. These are great shows. Getting a call out of the blue from the prime minister's office saying, hey, how'd you like the prime minister? And then, you know, it's like you're getting a little bit of that old JT charm. He's an activist. He'll say things like, well, the Conservatives don't even have a plan for housing. They might not have a good plan, but they do have a plan. And these are American hosts who are not equipped to say, well, that's not exactly true. But these are the farthest things from serious conversations about policy. And then on the flip side, he's like reaching out to like tiny local podcasts in Canada and offering them interviews. You were hearing about podcast hosts who are like, is this a prank? Why am I being offered an interview with the Prime Minister of Canada?
I mean, I think he did one really good interview, right?
What, the front burner?
Mine. With me, you...
Yeah, but you chased him, right? You yeah, probably were not a part of this campaign.
No, I kind of was. I was the first.
Oh.
To some degree. And I can tell you kind of what happened. Okay, I'll give you a little bit of behind the scenes. The last time I was on your show, we talked a little bit about your odyssey to try to get the Prime Minister to do an interview, and I was biting my tongue because I knew I had mine lined up for about a week later.
Well, look at you.
I know. My attempt to get the Prime Minister to sit down for this article I wrote in The Walrus was a six-month affair. It required so much arm twisting. At one point, I was told that they were worried it was going to be a hatchet job, and they thought I was out to get them. They sounded paranoid. I was told that they were basically doing no media. His media team was swimming upstream trying to convince the higher-ups in his office to agree to do literally any media. Clearly, the dam eventually broke, and they got a bunch of yeses. But you can see exactly what their tactic was, which was to go back to what worked for them in 2017. He did this big international campaign, you know, did GQ and a bunch of these other, you know, big interviews that was like in the first couple of years of his government, you know, becoming Mr. Liberal International, and hope the halo effect works back home in Canada. And back then it did work. I mean, you can't deny it was pretty damn effective. A bunch of Canadians were all smug saying, you know, my prime minister's on CNN or Time or whatever. It is such a bizarre plan to do right now, where people are feeling incredibly disgruntled. People feel like they're not being heard. People feel like he's not actually speaking to them. He's not actually reflecting the issues they're having in their day-to-day lives. And he's on Freakonomics kind of, you know, getting a softball. I think it has the potential to actually radicalize people further against him because, you know, if it does not feel like he's being given the gears a bit, which he's not been in quite some time in any kind of sustained way, I think people start to feel like he's living in a fantasy world. And I can tell you, having sat down with him for an hour, that was my conclusion. Absolutely.
It's not 2017 because it's 2024. And he can't do what he did back then. It was kind of neat to look at the cover of GQ and see your prime minister. Oh, he can't get the cover of GQ. So if he calls up Freakonomics, oh, sure, this is a cool opportunity. Let's have Justin Trudeau on. Same thing with Today Explained. That will work once.
Yeah.
They're not interested in another interview with him. There's a limited number of places where that availability as a lark for a slow news day is going to be of any interest. So you're going to have like a Canadian listener as your target who's like, oh, we're looking good. And it did feel like they were welcoming him as if he was 2015 JT. Yeah. Like, oh, here's this cool prime minister that's going to talk to us about how their social programs are great and some of the problems they're having. But it's going to be pretty friendly and we'll talk about literature. And as a Canadian absorbing that, you have this like reflected glory of like, oh, we still look good to them. And that's what fueled him in the onset. But if anything, it's just pointing out how different things are now. Like,
yeah,
he can't get the same wattage. He can't get on the same venues. It's sort of like his own form of populism, you know, like the kind of public radio populism as like, is that a counterbalance to like when Polyev went on a crypto show or something?
Well, I think it's also an attempt, and I know this word gets used all the time wrongly now, but I think in this context, it's exactly right. It's an attempt to gaslight people, right? Because the idea is you go on a show that's about, let's say, policy, right? Like Freakonomics. And you go on there and you explain how your ideology and your philosophy is leveling up the country into a new, great, wonderful prosperity. Meanwhile, the actual feeling that people have is that things are falling apart, right? It's this attempt to tell people that things are actually much better than they are, which maybe works to confront how people actually feel. And he isn't, right? Like, I sat down with him and there was this one point, because I've been kind of radicalized about his complete lack of action on housing for now, like going on like 5 years, just like a little longer than that. And like I said to him, you know, you promised all of this new housing in 2015 and 2019 and 2021. You promised this transformative housing strategy. You promised to kind of end homelessness. You promised all this stuff. And even the kind of the meager numbers you put in your platform, you only got halfway there. And I said to him, like, why didn't those numbers come to fruition? And he looks at me and goes, well, to some degree, they did come to fruition. And then he proceeded to go on to an answer about how it's everyone else's fault. Like, if you're not willing to own up to your own failures, then people are never going to listen to you. And I think it is emblematic of everything that's wrong with this government over the last few years, that they're not willing to engage with people who are willing to ask them critical questions. And the little kind of tap dance they do around press conferences ain't it, because all press conferences for him are just, you know, get a critical question, deflect it, repeat your talking points, right? Like, he's not actually seriously engaging with critical journalism anymore.
What was your highlight? I mean, when you're preparing for an interview like that, you want to very carefully craft your questions. And I'm sure you asked him some very tough questions. But the success of the interview is not fully measured by, did you put the tough question to him? Though that does have its value, just getting him on record facing a tough question. But what you really want is to hold him accountable if he does deny something or put something forward that's sort of dubious, like, oh, it did work to some extent. You kind of want to double down and be like, to what extent exactly? Can you quantify that? Is there a highlight from your interview where you felt like that's why this was worth doing? And that's what people learned from this. What's your favorite moment from this interview?
Yeah, I mean, like, that housing moment is really weird, but we had this back and forth on electoral reform, and it wasn't even something I meant to go into. And I asked about electoral reform not because I really cared about his thoughts on electoral reform anymore. This interview is all about whether or not he's willing to admit his mistakes and own up to them, and whether or not he's willing to change, right? Whether or not he's actually willing to sort of engage seriously.
I mean, this was the first big campaign promise. He was just like, yeah, I'm actually not keeping that promise at all.
And again, talk about gaslighting. There was this crazy back and forth with him.
But there's one thing that I was fixated on, which is, you know, the promise, the degree of the promise to make 2015 the last election under first past the post. And then the sort of the degree of the about face. And I'm really intrigued by it. I mean, looking back, would you do it differently? Because yes. How would you do it differently?
I would have said from the very beginning, it'll be the last one under first past the post, but it won't be proportional representation.
Do you not think you should have given people the choice?
I did give people the choice, and that's why this wasn't the last first past the post.
But you gave them a choice how?
I gave them a choice in that even though I was a deep and continue to be a deep believer in Canadians being able to rank on the ballot, that would have been a deep, powerful change to our electoral system. People within my caucus convinced me that if I wanted to do it, I had to leave the door open a crack to being convinced on proportional representation. And because I left it open a crack on that, there were too many people out there, including the NDP and others, who were proportional representation or nothing.
We spent way more time on it than I meant to, because my brain was just blown by the cognitive dissonance of him sort of blaming his own party, the NDP, and the Canadian public for why he didn't get electoral reform done, like everyone but himself.
He stood before the electorate and said, make me prime minister. I am going to bring electoral reform. That's what he ran on.
Yeah, fine. Who gives a shit anymore about proportional representation? For me, it was emblematic of the character flaws and the flaws in his government that has, I think, now become kind of, generalized into everything, right? Like his inability to kind of own up to some of this stuff, his inability to sort of engage with the criticism. I mean, people have been screaming from the rooftops about housing for years, and he didn't move on it until Pierre Poilievre.
Yeah, why start now? That's what I thought, listening to all those American podcasts where he's going on with his great housing plan. Like, why start trying to fix this now? Where were you?
Exactly.
I think you put it right as a character flaw, because I think under other circumstances, you would think that it's a slick politician wiggling out with some kind of long-winded explanation. But I think in the case of this individual, probably has convinced himself that he did not go back on a campaign promise, that everybody knew that was a fault. Like, that is a revealing moment.
Yeah, and listen, some of those character flaws are also, they used to be character assets, right? Like his stubbornness, his sort of personal investment in things, his actual passion for all of this, for politics, for public service, like those are things that helped got him elected. But now there are things that are holding him back from changing course. Like for the story, I talked to so many people around him, people who know him personally, people who worked with him, people in his caucus, people who used to be in his cabinet, and they tell a very revealing picture of a guy who's greatest assets became his greatest liabilities, and all of them are basically saying, like, if he doesn't turn this around now, like, he's done. And I think that's probably where we're headed towards.
I'll be sure to ask him about it
when he finally says yes. But I mean it is a little insulting that you couldn't get the better Justin, so you asked me to come on.
Justin Ling, the lesser Justin. That's Shortcuts. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You can email me about anything you heard today at jesse@canadaland.com. I do read every email that you send. Justin Ling, where can people find you? Where can they find your Substack?
You can find me on Blue Sky, which is less bad Twitter, or bugeyedandshameless.com.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Pruhl. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called, syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.